Good afternoon. So last time we went through going from our idea of pipelining to actually applying it to circuits. And one thing we discovered with circuits is that it looked like when we had, for example, our sequence of adders, that when the first adder had computed the result, it wasn't doing anything. But that wasn't really true. It was doing the work of holding the value it computed. So if we wanted to have pipelining in our circuit, we needed to add something to hold that value in its place so it could move on to computing some other value. And our solution was to add some registers to do that. And generally, our pattern for a pipeline circuit is we're going to have a bunch of registers between each stage. The registers are going to take the value one stage computes, hold it so the next stage can use it while the previous stage is using a new set of values. Then we looked at applying pipelining to our single cycle processor. And one thing we needed to do as a preliminary step is we needed to change the stages our textbook started out with. So our textbook had this PC update stage that was last, which kind of made sense when we were doing things by hand. We kind of think of, okay, I do the operations for the instruction, then I figure out what I'm doing next. But that doesn't work when we're doing pipelining because we want to figure out what we're going to start next right away so we can start its first step as we're doing the second step of the previous thing. This has a bit of a problem. We'll resolve probably not today, but probably on Thursday, that we can't actually always know the thing we're going to do next. Like if we have like a return or a conditional jump, that's not actually going to work. This is something we're learning is called a control hazard. We'll deal with later. But the common case, this is going to allow us to actually start the next instruction in the next step, not wait a bunch of cycles for us to figure out the next PC. So then we apply these principles to add pipelining to our single cycle processor. There was one additional step we had to do to make that work, and that was that when we looked at our circuit, we need to make sure values flowed from one stage to the next only. So the way our circuit was laid out, if we just like said this is where this, the fetch stage is, this is where the execute stage is, and so on, we found out we had some values flowing from fetch to write back, and some values flowing from memory to write back, and maybe depending on how you drew it, you might see some execute to write back. We need to have every stage getting its inputs from the previous stage only. Because otherwise, we're taking values from two different instructions. We have one instruction in fetch, one in memory, and if we combine their values, we're making a new instruction up. We don't want to do that. We want to keep each instruction's values together. So we rearranged our wires to do that. And once we had our pipeline processor, we wanted to get to the question of like how much were we improving performance? And sort of the key idea we had to think about was critical paths, because we were concerned about what's our cycle time. And we learned that critical paths also apply in our single cycle processor, just didn't come up as much there. But these are paths from some storage to some storage. They're what has to happen in a clock cycle. And we just look for the worst case of any of them, which gets back to our original intuition when we were talking about pipelining, that the longest stage is going to determine our cycle time. Then we started talking about some intricacies of implementing pipelining, and one thing that didn't show up in my circuit diagram was control signals. And these are going to be affected by pipelining because we need to apply the same principle of keeping values from one instruction together. So the way you're probably implementing your single cycle processor, for example, you make decisions based on the I-code, and the I-code is the value you got from the instruction memory. Well, if you did the same thing literally in your pipeline processor, if the I-code is literally coming from the instruction memory, it's for the instruction in fetch. If you're an execute, then you're making a decision on values from a different instruction with that. The solution is you pass the I-code and other things you need for control signals through the pipeline register, rather than just using it directly like you would in a single cycle processor. So before I move on to talk a bit about some cases where the pipeline processor we made doesn't actually work right and how we're going to fix them, questions about things we covered last time. Yes. So what is a control hazard? So by control hazard, I mean there are cases where we can't know what the next instruction to run is. So we have this notion that we do the PC update at the same time as fetch. And our PC update principally had this mux in front of the PC register, where we had an input which was PC plus the increment. We had an input which was the return address from the memory. And we had an input which was the jump or call target. And there's some problems here. So one problem is we can't know the return address until it gets to the until we compute the memory address to go to. We can't do that soon enough. So that's a problem. We're going to fix that later, but that is indeed a problem, something we're not handling. Another problem is that sometimes for conditional jumps, we need to decide between the jump target and the PC plus increment, and we don't have the information to do that in time. That's indeed a problem. We're going to solve that later. And probably by later, I mean Thursday / next Thursday. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So rather than talking about the control hazard problem, I'm going to talk about another problem called data hazards. I'm going to go through an example with our ADD processor. So in our ADD processor, let's look at this assembly example here. So let's say our 8 contains 800 initially, and our 9 contains 900. So let's go through what this assembly should do by just looking at the assembly. Let's ignore the rest of the picture for now. So we should take, we should put into our 9, our 8 plus our 9, which is going to be 800 plus 900. So that should be 1700. So that's what our first instruction does. The next instruction should put into our 8, our 9 plus our 8, and our 9 was just set to 1700, so that's 1700 plus 800, which should be 2500. So that seems straightforward. That's how this assembly should run. If we look at what the pipeline processor does, well, our first add is we're going to fetch it, we're going to get the, we're going to figure out we need to decode to read registers 8 and 9, we're going to get 800 and 900, and we're going to compute 1700. And, well, and after we compute 1700, our next instruction is going to be computing 908 plus 800. Why 900 plus 800? Because while we were computing 800 plus 900, it was fetching our 9 and our 8, and we hadn't written it back yet. So we have this 900 here that the second instruction got from the register file that has the wrong value because it was being fetched before it was actually written out. So if we think of the timeline, we fetched it just before here, you know, and it's going to be written out afterwards. So we have this disconnect here where we're going to get the wrong value for the register. So this is a case where our pipeline processor, we broke it, doesn't actually implement ADD correctly. And that ADD seems pretty simple, so that seems like a big problem. We're going to want to do something about that. So questions about why this happens, why we have the wrong value here. So another way of viewing this is that the instruction set says that the way these instructions are supposed to work is as if we read the registers for the first instruction and then write the result for the first instruction. Then we read the registers for the second instruction, then write the result for the second instruction. But the way our pipeline executes things, we've changed the order of that. We don't do the read for the first instruction, then the write for the first instruction, then the read for the second. We do the read for the first, then the read for the second, then the write for the first, then the write for the second. And as a result, we're reading the wrong values for the second, instead of the one that our instruction set specified should be run. So we haven't implemented the instruction set correctly. So we're going to talk about three different solutions to this, and I'm going to start with the simplest solution. And the simplest solution is that this ISA specification is really inconvenient. We're going to get rid of it. We're going to change it. And we're going to say that, no, that way we said add instructions work, that's not easy to implement. We're going to choose something that's easier to implement, and that's going to be that add instructions write to the register two instructions later. So if you want to implement this addition, you as a compiler or assembly writer need to add some knobs in the middle. We're just going to change the instruction set to make it more convenient for us to implement. So we just say all the adds take three instructions later by three. One is the normal, and we have two extra to go from execute to write back, and we need to finish the write back stage before we can read in the next decode. And this seems like just a crazy solution. That, you know, why would I tolerate add instructions that work like this? But this sort of thing, not with add in particular, but with other instructions, has been done on real processors, maybe even with add sometimes. But this is a real choice that some architectures have proposed and even implemented for some instructions. But people don't like it very much. So one thing is, if you're writing assembly by hand, it's pretty annoying. But a bigger issue is that this choice is really tied to our particular implementation. So let's say I had a different number of pipeline stages, you know, or I made other changes to my processor implementation. What we'd want to do is change the ISA, change the number of knobs I need to implement this. And the reason why people proposing this as a serious architecture for processors thought that was okay is that they kind of had the assumption of, you know, you just recompile everything, and the new compiler will figure out what to do with your new processor. But this is not the reality we live in. People often distribute pre-compiled code. Maybe that was compiled like 10 plus years ago. They're not happy about that solution. And people making processors feel obliged to make ISAs much more stable than this. So they're not going to actually do the solution for that reason, just because people aren't going to tolerate you saying each new processor you need to recompile everything, you know, to deal with the, you know, how I change my implementation, because I'm going to expose that to the instruction set. But this idea here that we can just make the instruction take effect later, and if you're, you know, doing something which would cause a data hazard, you need to insert knobs. We can apply that to make a hardware solution. And our hardware solution is that we're going to add the knobs, but we're going to do it in the hardware. Rather than having you write them in the assembly, the hardware is going to figure out that we need some knobs there. So we're going to have some extra circuitry that says, oh, there'd be a problem. We'd read the wrong value. We're going to add some knobs. And we're going to just delay that second add instruction until it would actually read the right value. And this solution is called stalling. So to implement this, we're going to have some extra logic where sometimes we don't change the PC. We just say, oh, I have this add instruction that wouldn't work. I'm just going to stay there, and I'm going to send do nothing values down the pipeline. So rather than sending the second add instruction from fetch to decode, I'm going to send values that do nothing from fetch to decode and fetch the add instruction next cycle until I get to a point where I can actually run it and it will get the right values. So what that would look like might be like this. So here I fetch the first add instruction, and while it's reading 8 and 9, registers 8 and 9, I'm going to realize, wait a moment, this add instruction I just fetched, the second one, I can't run that right away because of the registers it wants to use. So rather than sending its registers on into the pipeline, I'm going to send some do nothing values. In our case, we're going to send register number 15, that register none value, so we don't actually write anything later. And I'm going to keep doing that until we get to a point where we don't have a problem with reading the wrong value of R9. And we need two cycles to do that, because the way you can think about it is that we're going to write the value between cycles 3 and 4. So during cycle 4, we can finally read register 9 and get the correct value. Questions about this implementation? Yeah.
So the indication that solid needs to occur requires the second add to be fetched, right?
So the logic to figure this out would need the second add to be fetched, yes. And if we couldn't figure that out in the fetch stage, we would need to do something similar but later on. Of like not advancing the add instruction until it's ready. So I'm showing us making the decision in fetch. We could also make the decision in the code. It makes some other things a little more complicated, but it's possible. So other questions? Okay, so I've shown you this view where I'm showing you what the pipeline registers are outputting at each stage. And this kind of tells you what instruction is in which stage. Another way of looking at this is rather than looking at the pipeline register values, we can take sort of a higher level view and say, there is a specific instruction that's being executed by each stage, and where does it go to the next stage? And what happens is that our first add instruction goes from fetch, then to decode, then to execute, then to write back. And our second instruction stays in fetch until it's ready to move on to decode. And in the meanwhile, we send something to decode because it can't do nothing, right? It has a register file. That register file is going to read something. So we send what our textbook calls a bubble, which is basically just a NOP, down the pipeline, since we don't have any work to do right away while we're stolen. So questions about this timeline for stall? Yeah.
I was wondering, but is it possible to do the add R registers 10 and 11 while you're not?
So the question is, couldn't we add do the set add after this, the add R10, R11, rather than stall? And the answer is absolutely, this is something that modern processors do. The logic to do that is much more complicated. So we're going to talk about that a little later in the semester at a sort of higher level. We're not going to implement it. So for this add, it's fairly simple. But when we talk about doing this more in general, one reason why it quickly gets very complicated is if you think of an instruction that reads from memory, that can segfault. And we need to handle what if something that we're running in the out of order segfaults, we need to make that work. And that sort of thing makes it pretty complicated to implement. And we'll talk about that much later in the semester. Other questions? Okay, so we have a case where we have a data hazard, as I call it. So some terms here. So the term hazard is what I'm going to call something where we make our straightforward pipeline and an instruction doesn't work for some reason. So these are data hazards, where the instruction doesn't work because it gets the wrong data. I alluded to control hazards, which we'll talk about later. And this is a problem before we do extra work, like stalling or other techniques we'll learn, to resolve these hazards. And when I talk about hazards, I'm talking about a problem with a particular pipeline design. So we set up a particular set of stages, and some instructions have hazards. Some sequences of instructions have hazards. This is separate from the idea of a dependency. So I can have two instructions that depend on each other, and that doesn't matter what sort of processor we're using. And that doesn't mean necessarily that in our pipeline we'll have a hazard. So for example, if I go to here, in the add processor I showed you, there's no hazard here, but there is a dependency because, well, we can't run the second add without the first one. Right? We need the result of the first on the second. But it's not a hazard in that add queue processor. And I guess more notably, it would be a hazard in our five-stage processor because we need an extra knot to avoid the hazard. And to be clear that these are different things. So dependencies are about, you know, are we using something computed by the instruction in a future instruction? Hazards are, does this actually cause a problem in a particular pipeline design? And one way we've seen it doesn't cause a problem is if we, you know, just are going to read the right values anyways for data hazards, because there's enough distance between the two instructions. So since we've talked about hazards, let's do a little exercise about how they work with stalling. So let's say I have my add processor here, which has four stages, fetch, decode, execute, write back. There's no memory stage. And I'm running these instructions, and I want to resolve my hazards with stalling. And my question is, how many times are we going to need to stall to resolve the hazards here? And my recommendations for solving this is to make this timeline here, where you figure out during each cycle what instructions in fetch and decode. And what we're going to look for is, well, to not have a hazard, to resolve a hazard, we need it to be a case that when we write, that write's not going to happen until the end of the write-back stage. So anything that reads needs to decode after that, because decode is where we read the registers. And so make the timeline and figure out how you need to shift things around to make that work. I'll give you a few minutes, talk with yourselves, to work on this. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks we need zero cycles of stalling? It's already fine. How about one? Okay, a few people. Two. Okay, three. Four. More than four. Okay, so the majority answer is two. And what I'm guessing figured out is that you said, okay, so we're going to look at our add our 10, our 11. And we're going to say, okay, so it would normally have its decode in cycle 2. So our question is, are the values of R10 and R11 available? And it seems like they should be, at least if they aren't, it's because of instructions we can't see. So we don't need any stalling here. And this instruction is just going to go through our pipeline normally, stopping it. Then we have our add R9 and R8. So we'd fetch it here. And we want to decode it here, but that doesn't actually work because the value isn't written yet. By the first, the value of R9 is not available yet. So we are going to want to delay our decode by a second. And I assume, so that's how I would figure it out. So something that some people sometimes get wrong is you said, oh, we had two cycles of stalling earlier, so we're going to have two cycles of stalling now. That doesn't happen because, you know, it's about when the write-back finishes relative to the decode. And if we have instructions in between, that's going to affect that, just like why adding nops fixed the problem. So it's only one cycle here, and you say, okay, so this add R11, R10, we have the same problem between this write here and this add, so that's another cycle of stalling. That's probably the logic you had. But there's an issue here that when we stall at R9, R8, that also delays R11, R10. So we only have one stall. So the answer should have been one, because that stall, because we delayed R9, R8, and we're not executing instructions out of order, we ended up delaying R11, R10, and that was enough to make sure that its decode was after the write of R11. So questions about how I figured this out, why we have just one stall needed here? So that's doing stalling, so you can see sort of what we need to look for when doing stalling, and that, you know, sometimes it turns out that, well, we're delaying instructions. That's going to help all the future instructions avoid data hazards. And we could go into how do we detect when we would need to stall and implement that, but instead we're going to look for other solutions. So stalling works. It's something we could implement. And we're going to implement one case of stalling. A couple cases of stalling. We'll talk about exactly how we do that in HTLRS later. But it's very unsatisfying from a performance point of view. So we very commonly write code like the original add example I had, or even like this, where we use values shortly after computing them. And the stalling solution is saying that that code is going to run a lot slower. So it would be two extra cycles with our add processor, which doesn't have a memory stage. So three extra cycles with a five-stage processor with a memory stage. And more if we have a longer pipeline, which many real processors do. And there's actually a relatively simple way, well, conceptually simple, maybe not so simple to implement, that we can do better. And the big observation we're going to make is that even though the value we want to read isn't in the register file, it's still ready in time. It's still out there, and we can get it. It's just not currently stored in a way that lets us get it, but we can deal with that. And if we think of our original example, I had the value that was the 900 I read that was wrong, and meanwhile, in another pipeline register, is sitting the value I want, 1700. So wouldn't it be convenient if I could have used that value instead? And what this means was happening is that when we were writing 1700, we had 1700 sitting on this wire here, while 900 was sitting here. That's how we ended up in the situation where we were passing 900 to the execute stage while 1700 is going to the write back stage. So our solution would be to just have a wire connecting here to send that value back. Now, we can't always use that because, well, you know, if we weren't reading from R9, it wouldn't be the right thing to do. So we're going to have a mux there that decides whether to use that shortcut wire or not. But when we can use that, we're just going to avoid stalling entirely and still get the right value. And this is known as forwarding. We're sending the value directly to a later instruction rather than going through the register file. So questions about sort of the high-level thing we're doing here to send the value over. Okay, so more concretely, what this looks like is that we have coming into one register our 900 normally, but we have the new value of our 1700 available. So to get that, we want that shortcut, and we're going to use a mux. So we're going to have a mux there, and we need to figure out how to select 1700, the value coming in from the shortcut, when we're actually reading R9, and otherwise use the value from the register file. Now, this is just one case, and there's a whole bunch of other shortcuts we might care about. So for example, let's say instead of having the second instruction be add R9 R8, was add R10 R9. So R9 is not the first register we're reading, but the second. In that case, we want to replace the second register's value. So we have another mux for that. So we're having this sort of logic for each register we read, and it turns out we'll also have some more shortcuts we'll talk about later, more than just from this register before the write-back stage. So we have these muxes. Let's think about how those are going to look in HCLRS. So let's think about this mux, for example. So, and this condition here. So when do we want to take the value from that shortcut case? And in HCLRS, if we're following our textbook's convention, this input is called D_VALA. And this input is called E_VALE. This input, I should point to there, that input there. This output here would be called W_VALE. This input here would be called E_DEST_E. And this output here would be big W_DEST_E, this value going into from decode would be D_DEST_E. So this is, I'm just writing down names based on our naming convention. Remember, we have names starting with the letter for the stage they come from or go to, lowercase for outputs, uppercase for inputs. And our question here is, well, what's the condition on this mux? So our mux here, we have just two cases. We have our default case, which is we take the value from the register file. and we have our new forwarding case, where we take eval e, the thing that we're sending into this register here, from execute to write back. Question is, which condition is it, or none of those? I'll give you a minute, 30 seconds to a minute, you can discuss, people. Who would like some more time? A couple people. Okay, so who'd still like more time? So we seem okay. So who thinks A? B. C. D. And E. Something else. Okay, so looks like B and C are where we're split between, and. Let's say, first, say, can these both be right? Well, we're going to have a different register index here versus here, so probably only one of them's right. And the way I like thinking about this is that we look at the value we're forwarding, which is eval e, and we're going to send eval e along with other things from e, prefixed with e, into the write-back stage. So when eval e goes to the write-back stage, it's going to be paired with edest e as where to write it. So it's going to end up being written to the register with the index edest e. So in order to determine whether we want to use eval e, we need to determine, are we using a value that should, that will go to the register we're reading from? And the register it will go to is edest e, not wdest e. Wdest e is for a different instruction. So that would be if we had, that would be what we'd want to use if we were talking about this shortcut, which we will actually use implement two, but it's not the one we're talking about right now. So questions about how I figure this out? So the key thing I like thinking about is that in our processor, usually we're passing around a value along with the register it's going to be written to as kind of a pair. And we should be kind of operating on that pair together. In this case, the pair is edesd and evalE, and wdesd and wvalE are different, another pair of a place where a value is going to go and the value. We want to make sure we're using things from the same pair, or else we're going to have the wrong result. We're going to be confused about where the value's going. Questions, comments? So one thing you noticed here is that it was really handy to know the destination register. And this explains something I kind of did and glossed over earlier when I was talking about making our pipeline processor, that I moved the logic we previously had in writeback for computing the destination register to decode, which is what our textbook does. And a big reason why is that that means that I have the destination registers available right away, so I can use them for logic like this. Now, you can certainly implement a correct implementation of the pipeline processor you're going to have to do in future homeworks without doing this, but it's going to be annoying because you'll probably have to duplicate that logic that computes the destination register in a bunch of places. So that's not what I'd recommend. It's not what our textbook does. And related to that, our textbook follows this convention that makes implementing this forwarding logic easier. That in addition to computing dest and destm into code, basically as early as you can, they also have this convention about how they use what they call valE and valM. That valE and valM, they only set to the values that will end up in dest and destm. So if you're doing forwarding and you look at dest, you always know that valE is where you find the thing that that would tell you to forward. If you're looking at destm, you know valM is where you always find the thing that that would tell you where to forward. So you don't have to do this. This is just a convention, but it certainly simplifies the forwarding installing logic. If we didn't do that, we might say, oh, the destination register is this, but depending on whether it's like an IREMOVE queue or an add, it might be in valE or valA. You might have something like that. But this will avoid that problem if you follow our textbook's convention. So questions, this convention for HCL code. Yeah. Question, does the names ddesd, edesd, and so on stand for decode and execute? Yes. So these would be inputs to pipeline registers. So there's also going to be a corresponding output, capital EDSD, and so on. So it would be similar to the code I showed you earlier for passing the I code through the pipeline stages, where we'd have to declare a DSD in each pipeline register. And for the stages where we're not changing DSD, we still have to pass it from the uppercase letter to the lowercase letter to connect the pipeline register before the stage to the pipeline register after the stage, like you see. Like there's this representing this wire here, for example. We need to write code that does that. Yes, question? So the question is, why did I say they're passed through as evalE and valE, but not dvalE? And that's because in decode, we never compute a value that we're going to send to a register yet, if you're following our textbook's conventions. So even for IREMOVE queue, where we could do it in decode, our textbook doesn't actually compute that until execute. And if we're thinking about forwarding, we don't need it into code because we can't possibly forward from the code because any other instruction hasn't made it to the code yet. It's not going to be the place where we're going to add that mux. So, other questions? So, we've done forwarding. So, that saves us 2 cycles, even in our original case. But I haven't gone through all the instances in which we're going to have forwarding. So forwarding, conceptually not super difficult, but we're going to have lots of scenarios for it, which is going to be probably the thing which causes the most problems for students. So for example, if I have a similar scenario, I have R9 going between 2 instructions, but I have an instruction in between that should be irrelevant. I have the same issue, but the forwarding is different. It's going to be forwarding the value that's going to go into the register file instead of the value that's going to go into the pipeline registers. And why is that? Because we're forwarding from an instruction that's now in the write-back stage instead of in the execute stage. We're forwarding to the same place, but if the instruction's in a different stage, therefore the value we want is going to be in a different stage. And to handle that, we're going to have muxes that have cases for going from every possible place they could come, so from each stage. And when we have both valley and valm, we'll have to have inputs for both valley and valm from each possible stage. And that's where this gets kind of complicated. And you might say, wait a moment, is this really going to be worth it? Isn't this going to slow down our cycles? And it is. But all we're doing is adding a mux at the end of a pipeline stage. So basically, the added time to the critical path, in the worst case, is going to be the time for that mux, which is comparably not that much compared to even a relatively small amount of stalling's effect on our throughput. So this is worth doing, even though these muxes are going to get pretty complicated in our 5-stage processor. And I've shown you sort of forwarding paths for the simple add processor. And let's look at some examples of how this works out in our full processor. So in our full processor, we're not going to have 4 stages. We're going to have 5. And we can go through the dependencies to see if there's forwarding to be done. So first dependency I see is that the first add writes R9, and the second sub, the first sub, the only sub, reads R9. And if we're following the way we've done forwarding, we're going to replace the value we just read from the register file into code with the forwarded value. So we're going to take a value from the execute stage and have it replace a value we write into code, like so. And I kind of indicated that with an arrow. And note that if it's a valid way to forward, my arrow shouldn't time travel. So should stay in the same cycle, because that's, forwarding, going across cycles, it's not a thing we can do. We also have R9 being used by the rmove queue, the R9 written by the add. So that's another forwarding path, because the rmove queue would normally read the value here, but it's just before it's written at the end of cycle 4. So instead, we're going to need to forward it. That's that path I showed you earlier, where we take the value that's about to be written and send it to that mux. Next dependency I see is for R11. So subtract writes R11. The mrmove queue reads R11 to compute the address. So we're going to replace the value it reads before its execute stage, because we better have it by then, so it can do the 4 plus R11 computation. So that's another piece of forwarding. Similarly, R11 is used by the rmove queue. And we're going to forward it from the memory stage of the sub. So the subtract instruction doesn't do anything, quote unquote, in the memory stage, but it does pass the values through there. So that's where we're going to find them for this rmove queue instruction to read so it can do its address computation. And we also have our MR move queue. So it writes to R10. And the XOR reads it. So we're going to need to send the value that was read from the data memory. We're going to forward because it's not going to be written back to the R10 register in time. And fortunately, we're asking for the value after it's read from the data memory, so there's no time travel issues here. And there's one other dependency I didn't talk about, which is the one between the add and the XOR. So this is a dependency, but it's not a data hazard. So we don't do any forwarding. We look at what happens. R9 is written at the end of cycle 4. This XOR reads it during cycle 5. There's no problem. So we don't need to do anything special. It's just not a problem. So questions about how I figured out where we do forwarding in this example? Okay, so something to note about forwarding is we saw that we can forward from all the different stages. And something to keep in mind is sometimes there might be multiple candidates. So for example, the last add, the add R12, R8, it needs to get the value of R8. And you might say, oh, well, the first add, the add R10, R8, it has the value of R8. It's sitting on some wire in the memory stage. Let's use that one. That's a forwarding path we're going to implement. We saw that we needed that for example, going from the subtract to this RM move queue. So we're definitely going to implement it. But that would be the wrong thing to do. Because the add R11 R8 also has the value of R8. And which one is the one we want? Well, if we were writing this assembly by hand, like we would use the most recent one, which is from the instruction that is just above the add, not the one that's two above. So we want the more recent one, which is going to be from the execute stage, not the memory stage, because more recent instructions are in earlier stages. So it's going to be important when we implement that those forwarding muxes that we take this situation into account and choose the right one. This is probably why our case expression syntax has that rule that the first option that matches is what gets selected, because this means in HCLRS, what you're going to do is you're going to make sure you list the one that has higher priority, so in this case, the execute stage, before the memory stage forwarding case. So your HCL code, you know, if we're saying for val e, you know, you're going to have execute, then memory. So if both of them are possible, you're going to use the execute forwarding, not the memory forwarding, to make sure you get the more recent version of that value. So questions about our two options for forwarding here? So another thing that happened for our RM move queue that I didn't remark on it very explicitly is that often we'll have two different values forwarded. So we're reading two registers. Often both of those registers' values will be actually read by forwarding. We will access the register file and ignore its output. So in this example, we would get the value of R8 by forwarding from the memory stage and get the value of R12. By forwarding from the execute stage, and that's fine. We're getting our A register and our B register, just both use those muxes and are forwarded. And that's actually very common. And that's fine. We have two different muxes to get those cases. So, questions? So why do we need the first forwarding path? So the issue is that we also need our processor to execute this if this were replaced with R9, right? That also needs to run correctly.
Oh, okay.
So in that the other case, we would use that path. So we definitely still need to implement it, but in just for this code, we don't want that to trigger. Other questions? have some code. And the question is to look for these forwarding paths. So just fill in the blank. Is the register listed not forwarded or forwarded from execute memory or write back? And just as a note, since some people miss it, the last instruction is an AND, which is not the same as an add. Give you a few minutes through this. Okay, who'd like some more time? Let's see, just one person? I'm probably not. Probably gonna start. Okay, so let's start with the first one. So in sub Q, R8 is, so who says not forwarded? Okay. That seems to be the majority, and that's what I agree with. So this is not forwarded. And why is it not forwarded? Well, the issue is that our add queue doesn't actually write to it. So it's not computing a new value of it. We'll just read it from the register file. There's no reason to forward it, and also no reason to expect that we're going to have a particular wire that's going to have that value when we want it. So an XOR R9, is it, who thinks it's not forwarded? Okay, forwarded from execute. A few people from memory, from write back. Okay, so it is in fact, is it forwarded? From memory. And why is that? Well, if we look at XOR, we're forwarding to the end of the code stage. So we have to draw a line that doesn't time travel. We can't go forward or backward in time because we can't go back, we can't go forward because, well, you know, that would mean that our mux has to go through some pipeline register, but should that would be in the wrong place. And that means that we're going to have to come from memory, the memory stage of the add queue. So that's where we're going to find the value. Yes, it was computed in the execute stage, but that's not where it is when we want to do the forwarding. Okay. And in AND queue, R9 is who thinks not forwarded from add queue. Okay. So that seems to be at least plurality. And that would, I would agree with. So this is a case of the, we had two values we could get for R9. We can get the value from add queue or the value from XOR. And XOR is the more recent one. So that's the one we're going to use. If we use the value from add queue, we're going to compute the wrong value. It's going to be, it's old. Even though we could forward that value, it's out of date already. It's not the one we want. So we are going to do forwarding from AND to XOR. So is that from execute? Okay, so that seems to be the plurality. And logic is here. We're forwarding to the end of the code. So the XOR is an execute. So that's where we're going to forward. So questions about anything in this exercise? Okay, so it seems like forwarding has dealt with our data hazard problems, and that's not entirely true. There's one important type of case that we don't handle, and that's here. So if I have a instruction like MRMoveQ isn't the only one, followed by a sub. So what we want to do is we want to say, okay, so we're going to forward to the end of the code from execute. That's what we do if, like, it was an add that wrote to RBX. That doesn't work. Why not? Well, we haven't read a value from memory yet. So another view you might have is, okay, so we're going to forward from memory, but we want to forward to the end of a stage. We have to forward to the end of execute, which is too late for the subtract to do the subtraction. So that doesn't work. So here's a case where forwarding doesn't actually solve our problem. So this is known as the load use hazard in our textbook. That's the name they give to it. And the solution they have is that we're going to use forwarding and stalling together. So we could, if we just use stalling, we'd have to wait a whole bunch of cycles. So if we combine the two, we only have to wait one. And we're going to wait one cycle to delay the decode stage until after that value is computed in memory, so we can forward. And this is something you'll be implementing for our pipeline processor. And I've shown it with mRemoveQ. This applies to any instruction that reads from memory into a register. So you can think of one other, which is pop, where we'll have to do this. Some questions about our load use hazard. Okay, so what this suggests is that if I have an mRemove queue that reads into a register, and then I use that register, I always have to stall. And this is what our textbook basically proposes. But this is not actually true. So if we have an mRemove queue followed by an rMove queue, and this is actually really common in code. If you think of a memory copy or a string copy, like this is what some code might look like in assembly. We could do this forwarding by having the option to forward to the end of X queue, by adding a mux there. And why is that okay? Because the rMove queue doesn't need to do anything with the value of RBX. It just passes it through the execute stage. So with the subtract instruction, this wasn't an option because the subtract instruction needs to actually compute on the value of RBX. It's having it at the end of the cycle, not good enough. But with rMoveQ, it would be good enough. And real processors that have pipelines like the ones described in our textbook do implement this piece of forwarding. It's worth the cost because this sort of assembly code comes up often enough. Our textbook doesn't do it because our textbook wants to keep things simpler, even though, this would be faster. And for the HCL assignments, we're not going to check whether or not you do it. If you want to do that, great. But it's not going to affect your score, and I believe I've excised all the test cases that would care about it. And I think that's where I'll finish up today. So next time we'll talk about sort of generalizing forwarding and go into control hazards.